O'Connor and Ijoku caught up only once she had reached the cairn on the soft log, the Vardagr no longer visible. It was like the moment when the BL drive fires. As you travel to an if, said Moss. That moment you think you can feel every possibility at once.
Wally thinks a BL drive made this place, said O'Connor.
He was sweating, flushed.
I think a BL drive might have made this extraordinary place, said Ijoku. The tricky thing about Brant LaMonaco knots is that they exist outside of time. Almost a paradox. If we assume that a BL drive created this thin space, the Vardagr, then the BL could have fired at any time, including at any time in the future or in the past. We think of time as set, but time is mutable, non-linear. Imagine, he said. You see a burnt tree, coated in ash.
Moss nodded.
Now, imagine that the forest fire that burned the tree won't happen for another 300 years or 3,000. You see? Things like that can happen in a thin space. Quantum tricks. Time is like water here. Water that sometimes flows uphill. This thin space might be a consequence of an action that hasn't actually happened yet.
Nicole might have described this place. Obliquely, Moss realized. She had described ghosts in the woods that preceded their bodies. Marion, thought Moss. And another Marion.
I hear what you're saying, but I don't understand what this place is, said Moss.
Not what this place is, but what this place might be, said Ijoku.
Are you all right? She asked O'Connor, who sat on the log wiping his face with a handkerchief.
I'm fine. It was just disorienting, he said. I'll be all right.
One plank unit past now is the multiverse, said Ijoku. Quantum gravity is like a zipper, pulling all those possibilities together into one single truth. Terra firma. The thin space is like a moment when the zipper gets stuck a little.
How large is this thin space? Asked Moss. Just the tree, or do you think it's the entire forest?
I don't know. It's marvelous, but I can't even guess at the size, said Ijoku.
Most BL knots are only hypothetical shapes. More like math problems than geolocations that you can measure. There are only a very few BL knots that have actually been observed on Earth. And this one is very, incredibly unique.
These things are pretty rare, then, said Moss.
Rare on Earth. But our launch sites at the Black Veil are riddled with them. That's one of the reasons NSC launches from space, said O'Connor.
What's the other reason? She asked.
Ijoku laughed. Oh, well, you see, he said. Back in the early 80s, the Naval Research Lab published a report proving that a BL drive could spark the creation of a massive black hole. Theoretically, anyway. Our ships sail black holes in the quantum foam, but if something went wrong, frankly, the moon base wouldn't be far enough away.
You're kidding me, said Moss. Ijoku shrugged, smiling.
Math problems, he said.
We tend not to mention that fact in our annual reports to Congress, said O'Connor. I'm all right. We can keep going.
Black holes, thin spaces, said Moss, grabbing O'Connor's hand, helping him up. Where are the other thin spaces?
One in Los Alamos, three in the Pacific. All at early BL drive test sites, said Ijoku. Most of these things only affect particles. The thin space out in the Pacific, though, that is an interesting one.
Like this one?
Nothing is like this one, said Ijoku. The size of this one. We were inside this one. The space-time knot in the Pacific is considered very large, and that's only a few feet in volume. Not like the Vardagr by any stretch, but large enough to echo fish as they swim through.
Echoed fish, she asked.
Pacific Jack mackerel, said Najoku. You can catch a mackerel, but still have it get away.
The one that got away would always be bigger than the one you caught, said O'Connor.
We've observed the Pacific thin space echoing fish, but it is also a Goodall curve. That is, a specific kind of closed time-like curve, said Najoku. It's a very odd part of the ocean.
You mentioned that before. What is that? Asked Moss.
A four-dimensional Lorentzian manifold. Well, listen. If you watch that particular thin space long enough, you will actually see the moment all the original fish in the system reset to their start positions at the beginning of the cycle. Closed time-like curves are the closest we've come to traveling backward in time.
The fish repeat, she asked. You mean they're stuck in a loop?
Looping is a good way to think of it, said Najoku. There are various types of closed time-like curves, ways information loops through wormholes, going forward in time but also backward, arriving at the moment it began. I've dipped my hand into the water, and when the water looped, it was like I held a fish inside my hand until it flopped and squirmed out, swimming away. It was a very strange sensation. Slimy. You could cast your line into the water and catch the same fish over and over again.
Or pick a piece of fruit and see it regrow the moment you pick it, said Moss, remembering Nicole smoking her parliament, describing something like a Goodall curve when she had reminisced about her childhood home. When was she a child? Moss wondered. When were miracles like Goodall curves practicable, common on orchards in Kenya, put to use for agriculture? Nicole had never been hungry as a child. The fields never fallow.
The Navy will want this place. I have to make arrangements, said O'Connor. They'll need to fence this off. Shut it down. The whole area. Let's get going.
The stones were smooth along the dried creek, polished from the water that used to flow here. Moss stepped stone to stone as she walked back, following Najoku and O'Connor. Easy to dig out the flat stones for cairns, she thought. They were everywhere. Who had marked this place? The FBI had spotted the driver of the black van here, Richard Harrier, and had trailed him to Buchanan. But he wouldn't have been marking this place, she thought. It must have been the survivors of Libra. A BL drive had made this place. She peered through the spaces between trees, wondering if she might see a ship here. Nothing but trees, and in the distance, more trees.
What was her name?
Najoku asked once they'd reached their cars.
Whose name?
Asked Moss.
You said there was someone in Boston. You think I'm supposed to meet her?
Jayla, she said. Jayla, but I don't know her last name. She plays the saxophone. Moss waited in her truck while O'Connor maneuvered his Subaru from the clearing, fluttering brake lights as he inched down the precipitous drop. She was worried about him. He'd looked pale as they'd said their goodbyes. O'Connor would be heading back to D.C. by the afternoon, a several-hour drive. The Navy would occupy this place soon, the first contingent by nightfall, if not earlier. Najoku was flying out from Pittsburgh, but would return in a few days with physicists from the Naval Research Lab to study the Vardager. She was disoriented, still, thinking of the way the forest had seemed to fragment and multiply was like remembering a cramp in her eye. The coffee in her thermos was warm. It was peaceful here, but she felt like a leaf caught in an eddy. She had been drawn to this place in her far future, when she'd suffered crucifixion, and she had also been drawn here in her recent past, when she began the investigation into the Mersault deaths that had led her here now. A leaf caught in a whirlpool, a wheel within a wheel. Wendy's on West Pike in Clarksburg, scribbling on napkins. Everything has changed, but nothing has changed. Spicy chicken, no mayo. Paper placemat. Dipping fries in paper cups of ketchup. Writing, the anatomy of men and women laid out across the sky. Sipping Pepsi, sounds of ice cubes in a waxy cup. Writing. A rain of pollen in reverse. Writing. A strange symmetry. Cadavers in the sky and the hanged men. A pollination of flowers and the running men. Clouds had accumulated through the afternoon, a cold front sweeping in. A fine rain misted outside. Ma stepped out for fresh air, huddled beneath the Wendy's overhang, wishing she still smoked. The old addiction never entirely dies. Perfect time for a cigarette. The late hour, solitude, something for her nerves. A forest with doors that led to new forests. She could almost taste the tobacco. Wondered where she could buy a pack around here. Or even just one. Bum a cigarette if a man walked by. Her cell buzzed. Brock.
IDs came back on one of the Buchanan bodies we pulled from the truck with Marion, he said. I told the doctors to sit on this information. I thought I should tell you first, before we proceed.
He cleared his throat. She heard him struggling with this.
Positive ID,
he said.
No mistakes. Ryan Wrigley Torgerson.
Our person of suspicion for the Cetus bombing, she said.
He's like... Torgerson is like Marion, said Brock. There are two of them. Two of each of them. They're clones, or they're doubled somehow.
Focus on Torgerson. You've had him under surveillance?
I just talked with Rashonda. Checked to see when Torgerson had last been at work. And she told me he was sitting at his desk all day. Shannon, this guy can't be at his desk all day and in the autopsy room. He just can't be... I don't understand what's happening. I don't understand, Marion.
Where is he now? Asked Moss.
My wife just called over to Torgerson's place under some pretense. Spoke to his wife. He's there now. At home.
Let's talk with him, said Moss. I'm already in Clarksburg, nearby Cetus. I can meet you at Torgerson's. What's his address? Ryan Torgerson's house was one of a newer construction north of Clarksburg, a development built in the small boom following the Cetus facility's arrival. One of sprawling, identical houses, with prefab design her mother would have called McMansions. Moss found her way through the planned neighborhood streets, streets that were copies of one another, repetitive, plotted all at once yet strangely incomprehensible in their design, cul-de-sacs and loops. Night had fallen, windows of most of the houses bright at the edges of drawn curtains. Brock waited in front of the neighboring house, sitting in his silver sedan, a new model. The repetition prickled Moss, a shiver of goose flesh. She parked behind, joined him in the front seat of his car. She wanted to tell him that the last time she'd sat with him like this, he had just murdered two special agents. She wanted to tell him what he had lost in that future, and what he had already saved by finding Torgerson here. The scent of licorice, classical radio on low volume, Brock's face dewy with sweat.
How do you want to play this?
He said.
Ask him about the body we found?
No, said Moss. Ask about his life, his career here. He might not even know about that other body. In fact, I bet he doesn't. We need to poke around a bit. I don't want to just lay that on him.
Ashley Betak claims she didn't know what was happening in her barn. Claims she didn't know what her son was up to.
You got her to talk? Asked Moss. How about the guy she was with? Harrier.
He hasn't told us much of anything that we didn't already know,
said Brock.
And Ashley Betak just lost her son. When we broke the news that Jared had been shot in the firefight, she broke down. Only talked off and on before her counsel arrived. Outbursts of grief, sometimes not even comprehensible. We asked her about Mersault, and she said something about a lawyer he knew. Mary mentioned a lawyer too, didn't she?
She did, said Moss. Indistinct thoughts flickering in the back of her mind. Something she was trying to recall. Pieces she needed to fit together. I don't know if his lawyer is important, but we should track this lawyer down, she said.
I asked for the lawyer's name. Ashley Betak can't tell us, or won't tell us, said Brock. She's demanding a quick burial for her son, but the Navy confiscated his remains. She's not cooperating.
Ashley Bitek had lost her son, but Brock had won the lives of his children. How old are your girls? Asked Moss.
2 and 4,
said Brock. How old would his girls be in the year 2024, when the terminus was marked? 29 and 31. His girls will be young adults when the white hole opens in the sky. All of life was in a gyre, channeled to the same waste. They approached the house together, Brock knocking on the front door before ringing the bell. A light in the living room snapped on. The door opened inward, no security chain. The woman was slight, a loose sweater and slacks, house slippers. She seemed puzzled by their presence, but smiled, a suburban graciousness.
Ma'am, my name is Special Agent William Brock. I'm with the FBI. This is Special Agent Shannon Moss, NCIS. Is Mr. Torgerson home? May we have a few minutes of your time?
Yes. Let me just one moment, please, said Mrs. Torgerson. Please, come inside. I'll get him for you. Twin skylights were night violet squares in the foyer's cathedral-style ceiling. The floor was marble, a swirl of salmon and beige. Mrs. Torgerson showed them into the formal living room before excusing herself to find her husband. Moss heard her recede through the house calling out,
Ryan?
Torgerson and his wife returned together, Torgerson dwarfing his petite wife, the contrast almost humorous. Khaki slacks and a striped polo shirt that hung untucked, his hair thinning silver. A meek man, Brock had said. Soft, thought Moss, but with a nervous edge. He'd been drinking, the air wet with the stench of liquor.
What is this about?
He asked.
Mr. Torgerson, do you have a few moments to answer some questions for us?
Of course, he said.
Honey, would you mind putting on some coffee?
His wife vanished farther into the house, and Moss heard the kitchen tap spray water.
Or would you like tea? Anything else?
Torgerson asked.
Not sure if you're drinking, if you're on duty, or if we're after hours. Please have a seat. Come on in. What's going on?
Coffee's fine,
said Brock, taking a seat on one of the leather couches in the formal sitting room. Torgerson sat adjacent, hands folded in his lap. He bounced his knee, the sound of his heel against the carpet a repetitive swishing.
Mr. Torgerson, can you tell me when you began work with the FBI?
Asked Brock.
Sure,
said Torgerson, his forehead growing pasty with sweat. He wiped it with the back of his hand.
10 years ago, I guess? No, maybe 11 years ago now? Are you here because of some problem with work? I can't guess what that might be. I've worked in fingerprints. I was one of the few who came over from D.C. when they opened the new facility a few years ago. I can't think of anything that's wrong.
The Criminal Justice Information Services Building, said Brock.
That's right. Did you say your name was Brock? I work with a Rashonda Brock. I don't suppose you're related?
She's my wife, said Brock. She's mentioned you to me.
Mind telling me what this is all about? He asked.
I'm happy to help you. I just don't know what's going on.
How are you settling into your new space? Asked Brock.
Quite a difference, D.C. to West Virginia.
You volunteered to come out this way? Are you getting along all right?
I'm sure Rashonda's told you about the stresses. We're working toward a state-of-the-art computer system, a national fingerprint database, but all we hear are budget problems and software glitches, false positives, incomplete records. We're still working off of fingerprint cards for the most part. Some of the bigger cities are already computerized, and it's embarrassing, because they hit on matches in a fraction of the time it takes us to work through our boxes.
Torgerson's body found burned in the Ryder truck. The burned body in an autopsy room in Charleston. But here he was in his living room. An echo. Another echo. Moss watched the man perspire, though his demeanor was jocular. He seemed like he wanted to help however he could. But he was fidgety, moving strangely like an animal grooming itself, running his hands over his silver hair, running them along his arms, pulling at his shirt, little tugs. Glass crashed in the kitchen.
I'll check on her, said Moss.
The house felt open-ended. Rooms branching off from the main hallway, leading to other unseen hallways and rooms. No kids, Moss thought. The place uncluttered, clean. The kitchen was expansive, a cooking area centered by an island counter, a breakfast table and French doors that opened onto a patio and manicured lawn. Mrs. Torgerson had dropped the coffee pot, had knelt to sweep up the pieces of glass with a dustpan. She was visibly unnerved, crying. "We heard the glass," said Moss. "Here, let me. I'll clean this up." "Are you all right?" Mrs. Torgerson's friendly demeanor had decayed since she'd opened the front door, her complexion withered by weariness and sorrow, or terror. She sat at the kitchen table, apologizing while Moss tore off sheets of paper towel from the roll, picked up the larger pieces of glass.
"I don't know what to do,"
said Mrs. Torgerson. "Whatever it is, we can help you," said Moss, joining her at the kitchen table once she'd swept up the floor.
"Arrest him,"
said Mrs. Torgerson, a whisper, almost too quiet for Moss to hear.
"He's changed. He's so different now."
"Has he hurt you?" asked Moss.
"No,"
said Mrs. Torgerson, almost exasperated to have to explain.
"No, it's not that. He talks about things. He drinks so heavily."
"What does he talk about?"
"He wanted to move here," she said. "He had heard about this new building, Sieges, and was obsessed with moving here. I don't know why. West Virginia. We had no reason to transfer, but he was fixated on the idea. He talked nonstop about West Virginia, about Clarksburg."
"That was the change he noticed?" asked Moss.
"No, he changed before then," said Mrs. Torgerson. "He'd have these mood swings, highs and lows, and when he told me we were moving to West Virginia, I asked him not to. We started fighting. We'd never fought before. And that's when he started telling me his fantasies."
"What sorts of things?"
"Violent fantasies," she said. "He'd never spoken like this to me before. But he came home one night with blood on his clothes."
She cried heavily now, her face crimson, her jaw clenched.
"He was younger. He seemed younger. Thinner. He was drenched, soaking wet and dirty with blood."
"Blood on his clothes?" asked Moss. "Was he in an accident?"
"He wouldn't tell me what happened," said Mrs. Torgerson. "I thought he was hurt. The physical change in him. The weight he'd lost. At first, he told me he'd hit a deer in his car and tried to save it. But his story kept changing. And later that night we fought. When we were in bed together, he asked me if I wanted to die, if I was trying to kill myself by refusing to move to West Virginia."
"What did he mean by that?" asked Moss.
"I don't know," she said, shaking now. "I don't know. He told me that he had seen me die, and he never wanted to see me die again."
"Was he threatening you?"
"He was trying to protect me from something in his mind," said Mrs. Torgerson. "He asked me if I remembered the night we had my boss and his wife over for dinner. This dinner party we'd hosted years ago in D.C. Years ago. He told me that after my boss went home and we were alone cleaning up the dishes, he said several men broke into the house. Of course, I didn't know what he was talking about. Some delusion. I thought he was having an episode. I was terrified. He told me several men had come into the house and had tied him up, had held him down, and forced him to watch while they... while they decapitated me. Cut my head off in front of him. He said he saw this. He said that they had made him hold my head in his lap, and he was screaming, just begging for them to stop, but that I was dead and they..."
Moss held Mrs. Torgerson's hands, said, "It's okay. We can help him."
"And he said these men waited until midnight before they left our house. They put him in the back of a van and drove him somewhere.
drove him off into the woods. And he said he saw things. He couldn't describe what he'd seen, but it was morbid. He said the men made him cross a river, and on the other side, these men asked my husband if he wanted to see me alive again. They could give me back to him. And he said the men drove him home, and there I was, still alive, asleep, like nothing had ever happened. And he thought he had to keep you alive, said Moss. Is that right? Moving to West Virginia would keep you alive? He said we had to move to West Virginia when the time came, she said. That he had to be ready to do certain things, but anything he did was for my own good, that no matter what happened, he would protect me. But he's been drinking so much more, and now you're here, and I don't know what he's... What is he prepared to do? Asked Moss. What certain things? I don't know. But he isn't the only one. He said there are others. He doesn't know who they are, but they all play a part. Someone from the Secret Service. He said there were more in the FBI. He said there were people in the military. Ryan has a gun up in the nightstand. He never owned a gun before. I told him I wanted it out of the house, but he needs to sleep with it nearby. There are others. Torgerson pulled from the rider, and there were other bodies in that truck. Maybe their echo's still alive. Moss thought of Torgerson crossing the Black River, his clothes stained with his wife's blood. But his wife was alive. Hild Krugger, the devil. Can he cross through the Vardager? Was it permeable? A doorway to pass between worlds? Hild Krugger somehow traveling between timelines like a spider, crawling across the strands of a web, murdering husbands, murdering wives, as threats, bringing echoes here to terra firma. Secret Service, FBI. Moss imagined sleeper cells in high-security facilities, placed just like Torgerson, waiting to pull the trigger. How many others were there? An army of echoes? Shouting from the other room. Indistinct sounds, accusations. Moss heard Brock's voice, calmer. Mrs. Torgerson stood from the table, said, Ryan? She took two steps before the blast. A fleeting image of fire like liquid orange light cascading over the ceiling and walls before Mrs. Torgerson was lifted from her feet and Moss was blown backward. Moss swam upward from darkness, ringing in her ears, a tinny ring. Silence otherwise. Where am I? A kitchen. She could see flames, siren light. She was on her back. She was on a kitchen floor. I can move, she thought, righting herself. She tried to stand but wobbled and sank back to the floor, dizzy. Her leg was missing. Her prosthesis. Where? She looked around her. Saw a body. A woman. Mrs. But her name escaped. Tor. The woman was on the kitchen floor, screaming. The woman was at an awkward angle. Moss crawled. Brock. Brock! She screamed, but her voice was underwater. Brock! The house in flames. There had been a blast, she realized. She made her way through the hall, crawling. Drywall collapsed. Exposed timber, dust, smoke. Shrill sounds of smoke detectors competed with the ringing in her ears. What was left of the living room was on fire. The walls had disappeared. Black smoke crawled along the exposed timber where the ceiling had been, billowed from holes that had opened in the roof. Firefighters were on scene, flickering red siren lights. I'm all right, she said to one of the men. Brock, she said. Someone lifted her, held her. Brock, she said. Out! Out! A firefighter carried her, saying, Out! Out! Flashlight beams. Someone screaming. There's a woman in the kitchen, said Moss, recovering some of her sense. She followed the beams of the flashlights and saw the bodies in the living room, barely visible because of black smoke. But she saw Torgerson's body, shredded. She saw his head in separate locations. she saw Brock. His legs had been removed from his torso. One arm was gone. White bone, red meat. Moss screamed. Coughing, smoke burning in her lungs, she screamed and cried. Brock was dead. Moss was carried outside, a mask placed over her mouth, fresh oxygen to cleanse her lungs. She watched the house on fire, a radiant light. Part 4, 2015 to 2016. I will invite myself to this ghost supper. August Strindberg, The Ghost Sonata. 1. I launched in the Cormorant within a week of Brock's death. 3 months in solitude, the silence of the Grey Dove pierced by ringing in my ears, the lingering effects of Torgerson's suicide blast. My memories were spotty, like there were gaps where the film had been cut. One moment I'd heard shouting, the next I woke in fire and remembered only scattered images, flashes of the gruesome spectacle of Brock's body and Torgerson's echo, the pieces of them scattered about the burning living room. Brock's death wriggled worm-like in my heart. Why hadn't I known what we were walking into? My life was telescoping. I had lived over a year since Nestor called in the early hours to tell me that a family had been murdered. But those murders were still raw, just a few weeks old. I had seen the future, but didn't understand the larger constellation of events around me. Nothing was clarified, and that future had already dissolved like dew. O'Connor visited me in Clarksburg, at my office in Seges. We walked the corridors together, imagining this building's fate in a future that would never be.
I spoke with one of the doctors who treated your smoke inhalation, he said. He told me you suffered a perforated eardrum in the explosion, but no other injuries. The hearing loss should be temporary. How are you?
I can go, I said, even though his voice seemed far away, too soft beneath the shrill ringing. He wasn't asking about the smoke inhalation or the psychological trauma of the bombing. He was asking if my body could withstand the withering travel to a second if within a month. I'm ready. We spoke about Torgerson's wife, how her husband had been brought through the woods and imagined the Vardagr as an intersection of paths, the hub of a wheel with several spokes, each spoke leading somehow to a different if. There were other echoes that had already been brought through, we knew, waiting like spiders in their funnels, tensed as Torgerson had been, for Heildkrugger to pluck their webs and send them scurrying to the light. O'Connor studied the inventory of blueprints that Brock and I had recovered from Buchanan. Sites compromised by Heildkrugger's network.
Federal buildings, O'Connor said. NSC targets, launch sites, Navy installations. These are all support beams protecting us from the terminus, and Heildkrugger is preparing to break them. Why?
I would travel to discover what terror might still occur, then trace it back to Terra Firma. So that we can anticipate Heildkrugger here, now. Stop him. Before we parted, O'Connor told me that the Navy had secured the Vardagr.
A discreet presence, but they'll have the area fenced off soon. Njoku is working with a team from the Naval Research Lab. They've rented most of the cabins there, out at the Blackwater Lodge. They're going to study the thin space. Unlock it. When you reach the future, check in with us. See what doorways through time and space we've managed to pry apart.
The ping from the Black Veil's AI roused me from dreams of Buchanan, the lunar base confirming that my ship had emerged from the void. I glanced out the portal. Gibbous moon. Earthshine. I checked with the Grey Dove's autocommand. September 2015. Another if materialized. Another future. A second ping from the Black Veil. Black Veil approach, Cormorant 707 Golf Delta, I said, shaking away wisps of a dream. Nestor in fields of long grass, the night sky bleeding with stars. State your name and place your eyes to the onboard retinal scanner for verification. A sonorous voice, a computer's. breaking hailing protocol. The Black Veil's AI had locked into the Grey Duff's computers, as it should have. But NSC always manned the lighthouse with sailors. Something was wrong. "Shannon Moss?" I said. The retinal scanner was a set of goggles built into the control panel, and I lowered my face against the rubber mask, kept my eyes wide for the dull sweep of light. "Welcome, Special Agent Shannon Moss. Downloading clearance code. Contacting NetWarcom." "Wait. Black Veil approach," I said. "This is Grey Dove Actual. I need to speak with Black Veil Actual." "The lighthouse is dark, Shannon." Which meant there was no Black Veil. Not anymore. But there was no longer a lunar base. But I was speaking with a black box computer buried deep beneath moon dust. Or maybe a satellite circling the night. We were trained to remain dark in the event that NSC might no longer exist. To shut off all lights and non-essential computers. To wait in silence for the BL to reboot. We were trained simply to return home. A 6-month round trip that would have gained nothing. I flipped off the Dove's interior lights, the situation sinking in. But if there was no Black Veil, then NSC had been compromised. Or folded. Several minutes passed before I noticed that the Black Veil's AI had sent a message. I tapped the digital display, and O'Connor's face filled the screen. His skin mottled with liver spots and traced with veins. Wizened. His eyebrows bushy white. He was in his office, in front of the customary I Love Me wall that special agents usually covered with certificates and awards, but that he filled with framed photographs of his Cocker Spaniels.
"Shannon," he said,
his voice dried with age, reedy.
"If you're watching this, then you are in an if, and our nightmare doesn't exist. And I don't exist right now, which is a warm thought for me. Like I might still wake up from so many terrible things. Return to terra firma, Shannon. Right now. Don't wait. As of this recording, July 2014, the terminus is marked at December 2017. And it might have come closer still by the time you see this recording. The Earth. Humanity. There is no hope. I wonder if you'll see the white hole. I wonder if you're seeing it now. I wonder if you've arrived in the terminus. I wonder if you're alive. I wonder if I'm too late. Please go home, Shannon. Go home. The United States Navy has enacted Operation Saigon. We've evacuated. We will be gone. The entire NSC fleet will be gone, searching for other futures, other worlds. We will not return. But I have a word of warning about your time, about terra firma. The Vardogger, that thin space you discovered in the woods, is a dangerous place, extremely dangerous. Avoid it, please. We lost so many to that anomaly. Almost 30 men. We lost Wally Njoku and the SEAL team that went in to retrieve him. We lost physicists who were studying that place. Show this video to me when you get home. And to Wally. Keep us out. They are all lost. No one returns.
O'Connor's face disappeared. Replaced by footage of Njoku in the forest, near the Vardogger, the pines and the earth around him bronzed with evening sunlight. Time and date stamped, 4-23-97, 6:03 p.m. He wore a white lab coverall and raised a hood over his head as he spoke.
"Test, which number?"
"This will be number 17, said a voice, the cameraman.
"17.
Said Njoku, fitting a respirator over his mouth.
"Can you hear me? Okay. The Vardogger opens and... I believe it mimics quantum foam at the river boundary. I believe you can walk through it. This morning, I threw a rock across the river and saw it land. Somewhere deeper. We're recording now. The Vardauger opens on a regular basis, but we haven't determined its pattern. Approximately every 12 hours. If you're paying attention, you can feel when it's about to happen, like an electrical current creeping up your arms. I'm going to take a few steps into it, see if I can retrieve the rock I threw.
After a span of waiting, as he held one hand on the ashen tree's smooth bark, I saw Najoku's face brighten.
Can you feel it?
He shouted to the cameraman, smiling.
Goosebumps,
he said, running his gloves along his sleeves.
Ah, here we are. Are you recording this? I can see the paths. They're everywhere.
I looked closely, but found nothing remarkable in the footage. I wondered what Najoku was seeing, what he meant by paths. Najoku took tentative steps forward.
Set the timer,
he said, as he pushed through the boughs of dense pines and disappeared. The footage ran for several minutes, the cameraman eventually following where Najoku had walked, through the trees. He came out into the familiar clearing, near the Red Run. But there was no one.
Najoku?
The cameraman's voice during the few final seconds of footage.
Najoku!
The Black Veil AI ticked through its programming while I replayed Najoku's vanishing. The almost casual manner in which he'd seemed to slip away. When Najoku, O'Connor, and I had felt lost in the Vardauger, the area seemed to repeat, a recurrence of the White Tree. And when we saw the Red Run, it seemed like we had flipped sides somehow, that we would need to cross the river to return to where we were. Marionette said something similar, I remembered, that she had crossed the river. I imagined Najoku wading into the water, reaching out to retrieve his stone. Where had he gone? The Black Veil AI had contacted Apollo Suchek's computer system, had downloaded NetWarcom clearance codes. It had contacted NCIS to establish custody for the Cormorant. I saw the Crescent Earth emerge from the Sea of Night, stunning and fragile, but left for dead here. Discarded. Operation Saigon meant that only a few had been chosen for life. No more than 1,000. To grasp at extra years while the billions abandoned would die in the cold light of a second sun. The terminus was an onrushing death, inevitable and near. But there was no white hole here. Not yet. O'Connor must have realized, even as he'd left his time capsule warning, that I wouldn't retreat from this forsaken earth. I took a room at the Virginia Beach Courtyard Marriott, an upper-level suite, the patio view an expanse of ocean, azure water melding into azure sky. Evenings on the patio with cinnamon plum tea, scribbling notes, squiggly lines connecting one idea to the next, trying to visualize how all this death fit together. And why? Libra. Esperance. Terminus. I sketched what I imagined had happened on Esperance. Nicole's story of the flora, and crystal-shaped leviathans, of men and women lifted and rent apart. Heild Kruger's network proved difficult to track. I contacted NCIS, but after nearly 20 years, no one remembered my name or recognized my credentials, so I researched what I could on my own. Thousands of articles and long form available referencing domestic terrorism, terrorist activity during the past 2 decades. But most references to Buchanan were historical, speculating on connections with the militia movement or Timothy McVeigh. And many articles repeated information written in 1997, in some cases lifting verbatim from earlier pieces. I was surprised to discover Phil Nestor still with the FBI here, a decorated career. Maybe I expected another version of the troubled man I once knew. But ifs varied wildly in their particulars, in their individual fates. Whatever personal tragedies had pushed Nestor to live in Buchanan hadn't occurred in this future's past. We had discovered the chemical weapons lab. Nestor had been wounded in the ensuing firefight. Those events alone might have driven his life in a different trajectory, a different life entirely. His career was easy to follow. His successes, Capsule biographies were readily available in the news share, and I found a portrait photograph of him. Salt and pepper gray. Handsome. Sack of the Pittsburgh office following Brock's death, it looked like, and his investigations into domestic terrorism must have furthered his career, as he was part of the FBI's Domestic Terrorism Executive Committee. Based near here in Washington, D.C., I called his office. A calculated risk. He might know of deep waters here, just as Brock had known. And I worry that my name might appear on a list somewhere. Might trigger my arrest. A butterfly in a bell jar. His secretaries wouldn't connect me, though. I called his office several times, and they took my name and the room number for the hotel. But soon I wasn't sure if he would even remember me. My memories of Nestor were still warm. Only a few months since we were together in a different future from this. But those weren't his memories. Here, I was only a woman he had worked with once, a lifetime ago. I ran in the mornings, an outdoor track at Kellam High School, my leg fitted with a flex-foot cheetah, a curved prosthesis designed for sprints. The opposite of an out-of-body experience. Running was body without mind, purely physical. Step, breath, reach. Unassailable lightness. 400-meter dash, I said. Competition setting. Still self-conscious about speaking to the air, but I was familiar with ambient systems from other IFs. Atmospheric nanotech saturation by phasal systems. The air itself pervaded with microscopic tech that hung suspended like grains of pollen. Pixels of light and specks of sound. Everywhere I looked was lit like an enveloping television. GNC ads and interactive blips for activewear at Dick's Sporting Goods. Every dull spot of the track flashing like Times Square. Images hovered. Real-time heart rate, core temperature, calories burned during each of my runs. My personal assistant was a hologram who blurred out of resolution whenever the wind blew, yelling, "Another sprint! Another run!" A virtual gun crack. I ran. Gaining speed through the first turn, working to increase my speed. Pushing. But the hovering stopwatch blinked green to yellow as I fell from my pace. And as I made my last turn, I slipped on gravel and the sky spun, the track rushing to meet me. Chest first along the track, my elbow gashed and my knee, and I bit the inside of my lip. Blood filled my mouth and I spit a second mouthful. Fuck, fuck, fuck! Blood from my elbow to my wrist, my sock soaked with blood from my knee. I forced myself to sit up. Health mode still timed the run. Over 3 minutes now, flashing red. "Stop," I said, but my personal trainer appeared beside me. "Faster! Faster!" My prosthesis wasn't damaged. The knee joint looked fine. The cheetah foot scraped, but all right. I shook out my ponytail, tied it up tighter. Fatigue was settling over me. I hadn't finished my laps, but my muscles felt like they'd lost their elasticity, and my sweat cooled. "Someone else would quit," I said, looking at the blood on my shin, the cut on my knee. "Come on, Shannon. Get your ass up. Other people would quit. Someone else would quit." A ripple of depression at falling. The failure of having lost my balance. The frustration similar to the pervasive, sponging depression that had blotted that first year after I lost my leg. At having to relearn how to walk. At the foreign movement. At the realization that a prosthetic leg was a bulky weight affixed to my thigh. A dead weight I'd have to lift with my hip and carry with every step. Adjustments. Frequent trips to Union Orthotics and Prosthetics in Pittsburgh for resizing, to test different suspension devices, straps, suctions, choosing feet from a catalog like shopping for shoes. I'd met amputees who still ran, iron-willed, who refused to abdicate what amputation threatened to take from them. I stood up. I crossed the field back to my starting line. "Reset the stopwatch," I said. 0000. A throbbing knee and fresh blood trickling over my shin. "Someone else would quit," I said. I ran. I showered back at the hotel following the morning's workout, spreading Neosporin skin to cover the gash on my knee, when I heard the persistent cooing of a mourning dove. I wondered if a bird might have flown in from the patio, through the suite's open French doors. A dove trapped in my hotel room, cooing, until I realized the cooing was the repeating tone of a voicemail in my ambience. "Courtney Gim?" I said, engaging the voicemail with my assumed name. His voice filled the air like he was there in the room with me.
"Special Agent Phil Nestor, FBI. It's great to hear your voice, Shannon. I'm sorry it took so long to get back to you, but I was in Alabama at a training seminar. I'd love to see you, catch up, and I can bring you up to speed with some of our investigations. 7 o'clock in the lobby of your hotel? Give a call if that won't work. Otherwise, I'll see you tonight."
Many special agents who investigated crimes in multiple ifs swore by a technique called the memory palace. An individual imagines a palace and mentally places names, faces, or events in its various chambers. The idea being that it's possible to recall things forgotten or obscured if they're organized spatially. Special agents used this technique to separate their impressions of differing futures, one if from another. Some spent their entire 3 months in quantum foam meditating on these palaces, imagining new wings for each future they'd observe. I never found this method useful, or maybe I lacked the discipline to make it useful. But waiting for Nestor in the lobby of the Courtyard Marriott, nervous as a virgin on prom night, I regretted not having developed some sort of technique to help tease out my knots of emotion about him. He had lived in the Buchanan Death House, selling a killer's stash of antique weapons. Or he lived here, a decorated agent of the FBI. But I saw these discrepancies like an image refracted through different lenses, not as something essential about him. I had known Nestor. I could close my eyes and remember the feel of his body next to mine, the purr of his breathing as he slept, his habits and quirks of thought. That was Nestor to me, his core.
"Shannon?"
He wore faded jeans, a blazer. He smiled, shook my hand.
"My God, it is you. You look amazing," he said,
his eyes still an undimmed blue.
"I don't think you've aged a day. It's been about 20 years?
"Far too long," I said. He was weathered, but like soft leather, filled out through his chest, his shoulders. Weight rooms, I figured. "You look good, too." Remembering him in another time than this, how natural it would feel to lean into him, how familiar if he held me. But here we only shared crime scenes decades ago. "I think we last saw each other maybe at Buchanan."
"Right before Brock passed," he said. "I was worried about you, the way you disappeared. I asked after you for a long while, but no one would tell me anything."
"How's your arm?" I asked. "I think the last time we were together, you left in an ambulance." He touched his bicep, a gold band on his finger. Of course, he might have been married here. It shouldn't have stung. He rubbed the place where Jared Betak's bullet had passed through his arm.
"Old wounds never heal," he said.
Nestor went to the bar for drinks while I waited in one of the crescent-shaped booths, the Courtyard Marriott's lobby bar like an airport lounge, nightclub sleek but comfortable only for as long as it took to get someplace else. A bachelorette party at a nearby table, gift bags, foil balloons. 9 women, but 3 sporadically flickered. Momentary lapses, their audio and visual off-sync whenever they laughed. Illusions, I realized, present only in the ambience, and a poor connection at that. Some of them surveyed Nestor as he passed their table with our drinks, glanced my way to see who was with him. "I was at sea," I told him, when he asked about my life following Torgerson's suicide, Brock's death.
"You never made it to the funeral," he said. "I looked for you."
"I'm sorry about what I missed." Nestor had been promoted, I knew. And when I asked about his career, he said,
"We weren't investigating much domestic terrorism after 9/11. Our focus was on international terrorism, Al-Qaeda. It wasn't until the Stennis attack that we turned our attention back to homegrown psychopaths."
Stennis. SSC. The Stennis Space Center. A NASA facility that houses a field site of the Naval Research Lab. Publicly, NRL's Stennis site conducted oceanography research. But there was a classified NSC-NASA collaboration as well. Rocket engine tests and experimental engines. The casual way he'd referenced Stennis, I figured most people would know what he meant. That was connected to Buchanan? I asked oblique.
We think so, said Nestor. Let me show you. Law enforcement. Philip Nestor, 55828.
When he spoke his name, the seal of the FBI hovered between us. Another illusion in the ambience, but as real as if I could reach out and touch it. Nestor asked that I speak my name, and when I did, the ambience revealed data collected about domestic terrorist activity. Glyphs covered in text, pictures of wrecked commuter trains, mangled corpses, government buildings reduced to rubble. They've been busy, I said, scanning the images, the trajectory of what might happen. O'Connor's instincts had been correct. What I was seeing lent credence to his idea that Heilkrugger's network was attacking government installations, especially Navy or federal law enforcement targets.
They aren't like other organizations, said Nestor. They don't publicize their actions or take credit, so they don't get the media coverage of an Al-Qaeda or ISIS. The media narrative has been rampant lone wolf terrorism, anti-government paranoia, maybe organized through networks in the militias. We think these attacks are related to Buchanan, all of them, carried out by the same planners. And yes, they've been very busy.
I skimmed file titles. 2003, Stennis attack. 2005, D.C. Metro attack. 2007, United Nations General Assembly attack. 2008, NSASP attack. 2011, Pentagon attack.
Show Stennis Space Center, said Nestor,
and the file expanded. The table between us becoming a map of the facility in Mississippi. Fire damage to the building that housed the Naval Research Lab.
We link this attack to Buchanan primarily because of the modus operandi, said Nestor. Their continuing ability to recruit personnel from within highly secure facilities.
People with clearances, I said, thinking. Echoes.
Who? A Marine shot up the place. Blew himself up when security turned their guns on him, said Nestor. But what the news couldn't talk about was the similarity of style to the planned Sieges attack. You found the blueprints for the Sieges building with Brock, I believe, recovered at Buchanan.
Sarin gas? I asked.
The attacker detonated a bomb he had smuggled into the labs, sewn inside his rectum. His own body shielded most of the blast, which saved lives. A horror show. But his was the only fatality from the bomb. The fire suppression system had been rigged with sarin, discovered in the resulting security sweep. But the actor's body had dampened the explosion to such a degree that the fire system never triggered. The Marine was a lone wolf.
So he shot up the place, then detonated himself, I said.
He killed five, wounded eight, before he set off the bomb, said Nestor. Shooting randomly. He killed a number of researchers. I thought you and I might cross paths on this case.
You must have worked jointly with NCIS, I said, a frisson of deja vu at Nestor's words.
Yes, but more specifically, we tracked the gun the Marine used in the shooting, he said. Ran a ballistics check, but came up with false positives. The ballistics report matched a gun that we already had in our possession, the 9mm we recovered from the shooting death of Patrick Mersault. It turns out the bullets also matched bullets tested from Ryan Wrigley Torgerson's weapon following the events at his residence, the explosion.
The ballistics report matched all three guns? I asked.
I wanted to call you in, said Nestor. I tried to reach out to you, see if you could testify that these matches were false positives, but I couldn't find you. And then there were others.
Other matches? I asked.
Judges tend to throw out these ballistics reports in cases where we have this issue. But yes, there were other matches too. We earmark the cases, figure a possible connection between Mersault and Torgerson, the Stennis Space Center. But the matches might just be errors in the database.
They've got to be connected, I said.
We keep tabs on these matches as they develop, said Nestor. We just don't keep the individual cases open. Many of these investigations are strictly local,